welcome to a brand new episode of Star Trek Panel to Panel. This is episode number 6, for those of you counting, and I am Jeremy Bement, your host. I apologize for the long pause in between episodes, but sometimes life gets in the way, but here we are, back and better than ever. In this episode of Star Trek Panel to Panel, we are going to take a look at a 4-issue miniseries from the Deep Space Nine era called Hearts and Minds. The story originally came out from Malibu Comics back in the 90s. All of you comic readers out there probably remember Malibu Comics. They were ones who created the Ultraverse with Prime and other assorted characters. Heck, they even had a Saturday morning cartoon show. They were bought out by Marvel back in the day. But before that, they had the rights to Deep Space Nine, which was rather surprising considering that at that point in time, DC Comics had a Star Trek classic series and Next Generation going at the exact same time. And everybody expected DC to get the DS9 rights, but it ended up going to Malibu. And we got this wonderful story. We will take a look at this story. I will do a quick review of it, mainly because we want to get to the best part of this episode, which is an interview with the writer of said miniseries, Mark A. Altman. Many of you might know Mark from his podcast that he does. I'm very familiar with him from the Inglorious Trexperts podcast. He also has a show on Amazon Prime called Pandora, which many of you may be familiar with. And, heck, what am I waiting around for? Let's get into this podcast episode and jump right into the review. But first, a word from our sponsor, Hero Collector and Eagle Moss. I know a lot of us are coming upon the first anniversary of being locked down with COVID. I work in retail, so I was only locked down for a very, very short period of time because I was busy selling things. But a lot of people have been stuck at home over the past year, and I know a lot of people took up reading or got back into reading, or started reading even more than they had before. I know I've had a little bit more free time than I normally do, and I've been passing a lot of my time by reading comic books and collected editions, trade paperbacks, hardcovers, graphic novels, all that sort of thing. And one of the things I've been plowing my way through are all the old Star Trek comics. You know, stuff that I either read back when they were coming out, because I would pick up comics here and there from Star Trek, like whether it be the DC comics, those are the main ones that I read. I did get up some of the Malibu and the Marvel stuff after that. But it's nice to go back and read those comics that I read back then. Or, you know, reading stuff that I never read before. And the easiest way to do that is to check out HeroCollector.com and take a look at their Star Trek graphic novels. Now, I will preface this by saying they just announced not too long ago that they are ending the creation of these volumes. However, there's roughly 140 volumes that you can get that reprints the vast majority of all the Star Trek comics that have ever come out up to the IDW era. And actually, it includes a bunch of the IDW stuff. If you go to HeroCollector.com, you can subscribe. They will send you out a couple volumes very inexpensively for you to try out. And if you want to keep getting them, they still have plenty of stuff in their warehouses, and they will send out volumes to you quite often, and you can amass your very own collection of Star Trek graphic novels. This episode that we're doing right now is volume 43 of their collection, Hearts and Minds. So, you know, I've been working through a lot of volumes, and I think you will enjoy doing that as well. If you're listening to this podcast, you're a Star Trek fan, you're a comic book collector, combine the two things together. Instead of going down and trying to hunt down all these back issues of Star Trek comics, check out Hero Collector, see what they have to offer. It's a really nice way to get the vast majority of the Star Trek comics that have ever come out in nice collectible hardcovers, matching spines, something I love. Check them out, HeroCollector.com.
Incoming transmission.
In this episode of Star Trek Panel to Panel, we are going to take a look at the 4-issue miniseries called Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Hearts and Minds. This story originally came out back in, I believe, 1994 from Malibu Comics. It was written by Mark A. Altman, with art by Rob Davis and Terry Palloy, lettering by Patrick Owsley and Susan Dorn. And way back when. This story takes place roughly sometime during season 2 of Deep Space Nine. We get a Sisko with hair and no goatee, and as you'll find out when you hear the interview with Mark A. Altman, basically he was just trying to do a story that would fit in nicely with the TV show Deep Space Nine, and that's basically what it is. Let me tell you kind of a brief synopsis of the story from the back cover of this wonderful Hero Collector volume. A Klingon cruiser disappears without a trace, and the prime suspects are the Cardassians. Thirsty for revenge, the Klingons call for the aid of their allies, the Federation. Captain Sisko and the crew of Deep Space Nine find themselves in a tricky position. Their main goal is to advocate peace between Bajor and Cardassia Prime, but they must also act on the Klingons' request. So, there you have it. Basically, a Klingon warship disappears, and it's up to our valiant crew on Deep Space Nine to figure out what happened. The Klingons, as the story goes on, feel that a Cardassian ship has destroyed the Klingon vessel, and the Deep Space Nine is trying to not have a battle happen between the Klingons and the Cardassians right at Deep Space Nine. So that's why they're going and checking into this and finding out what's going on, what's happened. And that's basically it. As you'll hear when I talk to Mark A. Altman, my review of this story, I thought it was a really good story. It's very solid. To me, it feels exactly like a Deep Space Nine episode or a pair of episodes. I could see this as a two-part story. You have this big, massive potential battle between the Klingons and the Cardassians. You also have a couple subplots going on at the same time, which is what you would expect from Deep Space Nine, especially somewhere past season 2. It seems like that's when, to me, from what I recall, that's when they started getting into more like the Next Generation mold, where you would have a big story, but then also have something that focuses on a particular character or a couple characters. Mark did an excellent job of crafting a story that has a good, solid premise behind it, and following through with it. Rob Davis's artwork, I thought, was very well done. He definitely is somebody that I think fits the mold of a comic book artist who is good at capturing likenesses, but not to the point of overusing photo reference when he captures likeness. He is somebody who can take a real person and do a comic book interpretation of them and still make it look like kind of a cross between the two. And that's basically it. I thought this story, I enjoyed it. If you are a fan of Deep Space Nine, it's a story that fits right in, flows in nicely with season 2. So make sure you check it out. Deep Space Nine, Hearts and Minds. Today on Star Trek Panel to Panel, I have the pleasure of talking to the writer of a miniseries for Deep Space Nine called Hearts and Minds, Mark A. Altman. Mark, thank you for joining me today.
Sure, Jeremy. Look, it's my pleasure. Even though it was a long time ago, I had a really great experience working for Malibu. That whole thing sort of came out of nowhere. And then I was lucky they kept coming back to me to write more and more. But what was interesting about that specifically, I think I was writing an article about Malibu. I don't know if it was for like the Star Trek Insider or Sci-Fi Universe. I was up in Agora Hills where they were based at the time. This is long before they were bought by Marvel.
Okay.
And I think it was Tom Mason and Mark Panichia so I was interviewing them and it was really interesting because they knew my work and they knew my work for CineFantastique. And, I was pretty well known for my coverage of Star Trek. And they said, have you ever had any interest in writing for comics? And I'm like, it's certainly something I'd be interested in. They said, well, we'd love to, see if you might be interested in doing a Star Trek for us. And at the time it was probably, I don't know. It was probably about deep into the first season of Deep Space Nine. There hadn't been seasons and seasons that had aired. There wasn't the show hadn't really
found itself yet. Mm-hmm. And so I basically said, okay, this sounds great. And they said, okay, well, you know, pitch us something. So I basically pitched them what was originally was the issue number 7 and 8 and 9 of Deep Space Nine. It was called, Requiem, which was basically Anne Frank on Deep Space Nine. It was the story of Anne Frank on Deep Space Nine. Really turned out phenomenally well. I was really very pleased with the whole thing. And so...
comic, and I couldn't do it in one issue. So I this is sort of what happened with my book, The 50-Year Mission, many years later. I came to them, I said, look, is there any way we can extend this to 2 issues? And I think, you know, since I had never done anything for them before, you know, they quite, you know, weren't sure what to make of it. So I gave them the first issue, and they loved it. And they said, okay, let's make it a two-parter. And we ended up making it a two-parter, and they were so happy with Requiem, you know, and I have to say, so was I.
Uh-huh.
That they said, you know, we want to do, the comics are selling really well. We want to do a miniseries. We want to do a 4-part miniseries. Is that something you'd be interested in? And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. I'd love that. And so I pitched them Hearts and Minds, which was really, I didn't have it all worked out at the time, but I, you know, I gave them the sort of rough version of it, you know, going to the Gamma Quadrant and they encounter, you know, mysterious alien race and they have to team up with the Klingons and all that. And so the response was great. You know, they were like, okay. And so I remember I did my outline and I got approved by Paramount pretty quickly. And then I had to write the comic and, you know, I was teaching myself how to write comics as we went.
I was going to say, did you didn't have a lot of experience comic writing when all this kind of came about. So did you like have any resources to go with or people to talk to about how do I go about writing comics or did you just kind of do it all on the fly?
I literally had them send me scripts for a couple of issues prior. Uh-huh. And so I looked at the format and then basically adapted the format and, you know, learned that at least the way that they worked, it was different than the Marvel style, but describe the panel and then you would have the dialogue and each of the word balloons. And I, you know, picked that up pretty quickly. Uh-huh. And, you know, especially I think after, everyone was so pleased with the way Requiem came out that, you know, Hearts and Minds was good because Requiem was something they could have done on the show. It was a very character oriented episode or comic. Uh-huh. Whereas Hearts and Minds, the idea was just to be like a season finale. It was going to be a miniseries, so let's make it big. Let's blow things up, and let's have a lot of action and a lot of space and go a lot of different places. And I never thought at the time that I would introduce this character of the Klingon, Kaletha, and then he would come back because the response, as often is the case with Klingons, is people loved all the Klingon stuff. So then, you know, we brought some of them back for a one shot, which was called Lightstorm. And I was able, you know, sort of bring some of the characters from that, that back, which were nice because it was kind of like this little, you know, it was sort of my little part of the universe, but it was really a challenge to write at that time because not that many episodes had aired. So you were really going from, you know, what you had seen those first couple episodes and then also the Bible, the writer's Bible for the show. Uh-huh. And that's why a lot of stuff that I used was stuff that was in the writer's Bible for Deep Space Nine, but they never did in the show. Like it was really interesting that there was, you know, in the writer's Bible, that part of Deep Space Nine was uninhabitable due to the radiation from some of the reactors that had been sabotaged by the Cardassians when they quit the, you know, it's sort of like, you know, when the Germans were fleeing as the Soviets and the British and the Americans were closing in on them in World War II. It was sort of analogous. And it was so interesting that they had this whole sense of what the space station was like and that there were, you know, parts of the space station. So that stuff was never addressed in the show, but it was all in the Bible that Michael Piller and Rick Berman had written for the show. And so I really loved all that and used it when I was writing my first Deep Space Nine comic, you know, and, and also you see that side of, certainly that side of Julian Bashir early on, where he was sort of young and hitting on everything that moved and naive. Yeah. And obviously that character changes and evolves so dramatically throughout the course of the series. But when I was writing these comics, that was the way Bashir was being written in the TV show. So that's kind of the way I wrote him in the comics as well. And I did the same thing, because when I did Deep Space Nine number zero, which was going to be the origin of the space station of Tarok Nor, which is probably my favorite of all the comics. I did this wraparound where, it's Julian and Dax at this museum on Bajor, and, you know, he's hitting on her sort of, and he's just really annoying. And it's so mired in that whole, thing. And it's interesting because, of course, later on they did an episode of the show many years later called Tarok Nor that sort of, I think, rendered my version, not canon, but I basically done the Fountainhead, and, I was so happy with the way that turned out, particularly because the artist on that was a guy named Trevor Boland, who was a concept artist for movies and TV. And he painted, as opposed to, a lot of the other artists who did a nice job on the regular comic. This guy, he really took it seriously, and he had brought in a bunch of, models and like he set up, panels on his own and like photo reference and really just did an extraordinary job. Every time I run into him, I would just say what a fan I was of what he did with that, with Tarok Nor. So anyway, that's a short or maybe a long version of how, I ended up doing these Deep Space Nine comics.
Well, I'm interested in the way you said that, how Hearts and Minds was kind of like a season finale concept that you wanted to do. When I've reread it just recently, it definitely has that feel to me. Like, there's an awful lot going on, and you have an awful lot of action and people and everything packed into the story. When you were asked to do this story, how much of that did they say you can, you know, have free reign, use whatever you want? Did they give you any, you need to include this or that or this race or that race in it?
Yeah. Now remember, this is probably 25 years ago. But I would say, to the best of my knowledge, I don't recall there really being any restrictions. Okay. You know, occasionally, I think Margaret Clark or whoever it was who was handling the licensed products over Paramount, occasionally get a couple of things to change. I know that some of the nudity in Tarok Nor, they you know, which is mostly an art thing, got kicked back and had to be changed a little bit by the artist, or more silhouette-y and stuff. But it was definitely, there wasn't, they didn't really tell me much. You know, you send the outline, they're very good about not interfering. And I know that later on when I did my original Star Trek for DC, I think I got more notes on that than I did on the Deep Space Nine stuff, if I recall, which is interesting because Deep Space Nine, of course, was actually a show that was actively in production versus, you know, TOS, which had long been out of production. But I did want to, you know, it takes a little getting used to. It's like what they used to say about the Star Trek animated series. Oh, what's great about animation is you can do anything, as opposed to, you know, the show where there are limitations of budget and money and all that stuff. But the thing about Star Trek is you don't want to do everything, because then it's not Star Trek, you know, and that was you couldn't have races that are bunnies, and you can't have giant. There's a lot of things you don't want to do, because all of a sudden it feels like Star Wars or Galactica, and it doesn't feel like Star Trek. But at the same time, the nature of comics is stuff has to happen. You don't want to just have a bunch of talking heads. You know, Nicholas Meyer famously said, you know, Star Trek's a radio show and Mission Impossible is a movie. Uh-huh. And I think that, you know, that was the challenge. And certainly with Requiem, that could have been a bottle show. And I think that, you know, I tried to open it up as much as possible and write it as cinematically as possible, but it was much smaller. So I knew with Hearts and Minds, I really wanted to take advantage of the canvas. And at that point, they hadn't really been going to the Gamma Quadrant that much in the series. So this was really a chance to show something, you know, very, very cool. And also, I love the geopolitics of Deep Space Nine. So, you know, I had the Klingons, and we had the Cardassians, and, you know, this is long before the Dominion. And it was really, you know, really fun. And just also, you know, I loved episodes of Next Generation, like Manor of Honor and Heart of Glory, where you kind of see humans having to deal with Klingons and Klingons dealing with humans. And even though they were allies, what an uneasy truce that is, you know, because the civilizations are so different. And that was something that I tried to capture in, you know, in Hearts of Glory. And then it's interesting because I believe that I called all four issues, just like what I did many years later with my TV show Pandora. Every issue, in the case of TV show, every episode was named after a Bob Dylan song. Because I know one was Masters of War. No, maybe they weren't. Maybe it was just Masters of War, because there were four issues. I know one was Masters of War, which was named for the Dylan song. But then there were a couple of, I don't remember the other three. So maybe I didn't name them after Dylan songs. Maybe it was just that one. But yeah, it was. But you know, I love just the fact that it was all the backstabbing and the twists and the turns and the, you know, when the Klingon ship is destroyed, and you're really right for the cliffhanger, much like a season finale or a two-part episode. You want to go out so that the next month people are running to the newsstand or ordering, you know, that the next issue. And this was during the heyday of, you know, back when you would go to Comic-Con at that era, there were so many of these new companies. It was like Techno Comics and Big Comics and Speculators were all over the comic. It was, your comics were huge. This was probably like the heyday of comics. So I remember that Malibu, because they were doing so well, was doing so many alternate covers. There's even a great lenticular cover of Hearts and Minds that they put out, you know, which is sort of, I don't even know if I have every version that they did, because they were doing so many. I mean, I somehow would find out when I was doing like signings at a comic book convention or at a Star Trek convention, I was signing.
I bring something up to you and you're like, oh, I never saw this before.
I've never seen it. Exactly. It's like, wow, that's really cool. Can I have it? No. There were so many different versions and, you know, different covers and stuff. Some were great, some weren't, but the lenticular cover was really wild.
So when you were writing the Deep Space Nine comic, like you said, Deep Space Nine hadn't been on all that long. Were you a fan of the show? Did you think it was going to be kind of a challenge to write a comic based on how much you liked or disliked the show? Or how much you had seen of the show at that point?
Yeah, well, I love Deep Space Nine, even, you know, at the very beginning. I mean, obviously, Emissary is a great pilot. And then, you know, it sort of struggles for a little while with some fairly weak episodes. But I loved the premise. I loved the characters. You know, when it was working, it was really working. And, you know, by the end, you get to first season with, like, Duet and the Name of the Prophets and episodes like Progress. It's really great. So, even then, I had very high hopes for Deep Space Nine, which ultimately were exceeded. But, at that point, you know, we wanted to write for TV. I wasn't writing for TV. I hadn't done Free Enterprise, my first movie yet. So, it was kind of like, you know, this was great. You know, writing for comics was like great. Plus, you know, I grew up reading comics. So it was, and I grew up reading, you know, Star Trek comics, you know, with first Gold G and then later, with DC, Marvel and DC. So I was, you know, I mean, look, I had every episode of the Battlestar Galactica comic, and if I could read that, I could read anything. So I was really excited. I mean, when they came to me and said, "Are you interested?" I was like, "Absolutely!" I would love to, and I was super thrilled to have the opportunity. And I just loved everyone at Malibu, and it was great because after I did Hearts and Minds, then I remember. You know, they kept bringing me back to do more issues, and we got to the point where it looked like they were going to get the Voyager license. So they wanted me to do this miniseries that would set up Voyager. You know, I did this thing called Soldier of Peace, which is my least favorite of the three of the miniseries I did. But I did Soldier of Peace, and that was a three-parter. And, you know, it sort of ends with the disappearance of the Voyager and with them trying to find the Voyager. And so, and then they didn't get the rights because I guess they were getting sold to Marvel, and Marvel Paramount Comics got the right to Voyager. And so it never went anywhere because they'd been talking to me about, you know, doing the Voyager comic and doing this whole crossover and teeing it all up. But, you know, that was, that was super fun. So I was really, you know, I was really just happy to have the opportunity, and they were just all so wonderful at Malibu. They were great, you know, and I think it helped that, you know, they weren't in New York. They were out here in California. So, you know, I would go up there and I would see them. Yeah. We'd have lunch and we'd talk about the whole thing. And it was a really terrific, you know, really terrific experience. And, you know, I just loved having the chance to be in that universe also, because, of course, you know, I never wrote for Star Trek, but this was as close as I got, which is, you know, write this, you know, Deep Space Nine comic. And then, you know, later on, the when I did the DC original comics.
Yeah. The artist for this miniseries that you did was Rob Davis. And rereading the story, I had forgotten how well of an artist he is when it comes to doing likenesses of characters and not necessarily making it look super photorealistic, but he does a good job of making the likenesses fit the, like, what a comic should look like a comic book version of that character. What was it like working with Rob?
I didn't have much dealing with Rob or Terry Pallett, who I think was the inker on it.
Yeah, that's great.
Literally once I would do the issue, you know, I don't recall having really any dealing with him. Maybe he had a question or two about the script, but he was generally very faithful to what I, you know, in terms of what I described the panels as. And he was an old pro. I mean, he had done other issues, and I think he was, you know, he was the old pro from Dover. So he got it done. I think he did a really good job with the likenesses. I think he was a very talented artist, but I didn't really have much to do with him. If I recall, this might have been before email. I'm trying to remember. I don't remember if I faxed the scripts or if I was able to email them. I don't remember. So if it was before email, I don't even know how I would have dealt with him. I mean, again, it's a little hazy, unfortunately. But
sure. It was back far enough back in the day where it wasn't as easy as it is now to get a hold of somebody. You can just, you know, hit him up on Messenger or something like that.
Yeah, because I remember, you know, when I first started writing for Cine Fantastic, I was writing all those double issues and everything. I would literally either overnight via FedEx, these giant manuscripts, or if we were really on deadline, I would have to fax it. And then he would fax me back, like, stuff to do captions and things like that. And I remember my first fax machine, the editor of Cine Fantastic paid for it. He said, look, you need a fax machine so we can communicate. So I'm going to, you know, just buy one and I'll reimburse you. And that was like my first fax machine, you know, and that was the way we operated for a couple of years before, you know, email.
Yeah.
You know, thank God that's a thing of the past. Yeah. I mean, that was the worst.
Yeah.
And, you know, even now you talk to kids of a certain age about, oh, send me an email. They're like, well, yeah, I'm going to text you. They don't, email seems antediluvian.
Yeah. It's amazing how things have progressed and changed over the years.
I'm not a big fan of texting for anything unless it's immediate stuff. Like if it's something I need to talk to somebody right away or following up on something that needs attention. You know, if it's something that's not urgent, I'd rather somebody send me an email. It's like I get, you know, but that's partially just because I'm so busy with so many things. But I still think there's a place for email in the universe for sure.
Oh, definitely. One of the things I found interesting when I was reading the story is that the big baddies at the end up being the Romulans, but you have a scene where Jadzia Dax is talking about how she knew a Romulan a long time ago. At that point in time, did we know a lot about the Dax's past lives? And did you have any problem doing this little, basically it's kind of a few panels talking about a previous life of hers?
Yeah, we didn't know anything really, you know, other than that she had multiple hosts, and that she, you know, and we knew about Curzon because of his relationship with Sisko.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
No, we didn't. And I know, you know, that was always the concern. They didn't want to create, you know, add to the mythology where it potentially would be contradicted by something that would come later in the show. So I'm surprised that got through. But one of the things I always did was I always tried to drop in a lot of references. That's why, like, oh, the Battle of Donna 2-5 was fought near here, you know, which is a reference to Tribbles and things like that. So I have a feeling I was trying to imply that was Romulan that we knew, you know, and so I was dropping a lot of references in my, to TOS, to TNG. Yeah, I'm actually surprised that made it in, because they were very, that was the one thing you asked earlier. It's like, you know, was there stuff they didn't want you to do? And it was usually stuff that potentially would be contradicted later on in the TV series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why I was kind of wondering. My memory is not the best in the world, especially when it comes to Star Trek stuff. But I was trying to, I was trying to place when the series was set in the timeline of Deep Space Nine being on TV to see, you know, was this a reference or not? Or were they being generous enough to you to say, yeah, go ahead and, you know, we'll let this go?
I also think they said, you know, she had so many hosts. I guess they assumed that they were never on the TV series going to explain every host that she had.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so if I say, oh, it was a Romulan, you know, it's fine. It's probably not going to be, contradicted. I didn't even say it was a Romulan. I guess they knew a Romulan. So, you know, it's ambiguous enough that you can get away with it. And that was the key, like sort of knowing, you know, what to do without going up to the line, but not going over the line.
Yeah, exactly.
But I have to say, I wasn't sure, you know, what it would be like working with, you know, at that time it was Paramount, not CBS, you know, in terms of, because I don't do well with like people like coming in, you know, it's like dealing with the network. It's like, oh, we don't want this, or we would change this. And they were great. I have to say, everyone there really loved Star Trek, you know, I wasn't getting dopey notes, and like people were very well versed in it. And so it was a very pleasant surprise, and that the whole experience was very smooth and, you know, very positive.
Oh, well, that's good to hear. The other thing I enjoyed when I was reading the story was that you captured the feel of all the different characters very well, considering that I know there wasn't a lot of TV reference for you to go on with this. Were there certain characters that you had gravitated towards by watching the show that you enjoyed writing in this story, as opposed to other ones that maybe not so much?
That's interesting. That's a really good question, because the thing was, obviously I had been covering Deep Space Nine for CineFantastic, so I'd spent a lot of time on set and I got to know most of the actors. So I think when I was writing the comic, you know, I kind of went back to who I liked. Like, for instance, I love Terry Farrell. She's funny. Obviously, she's beautiful. She was really just a delightful person. She was a big original Star Trek fan. So I loved writing Dax. You know, that was a no-brainer. Obviously, anything with Klingons, always fun. Alexander Siddig, also lovely guy, very easy to write for. But I mean, one of the people I just absolutely adore was Nana Visitor. You know, and the character. And so I think that's why Requiem was so, you know, she's the one who finds the little girl's diary for all intents and purposes, and then becomes obsessed with finding out if she's still alive. I mean, I just think it's so powerful. I mean, I can't believe in a comic book I was able to pull off something so powerful. I mean, I was really, I was concerned. I was concerned that specifically wouldn't land. But I think it really does, and sort of validated by some of the mail. Again, we go back to email. It was all like letter mail. I mean, they would forward on me to me like letters that fans were sending, and then it would be in like the letter column. And was like, it wasn't like I was getting emails or definitely not tweets or anything like that. So that was back when I used to read the reviews. You know, anybody who's been in this business long enough stops reading reviews, but you know, back then I was very curious to see what people were saying back when I cared what people said. And, and so it was really gratifying to see how good the response was. I was really, really, really happy. And, so that was, knowing the cast, and having gotten a sense of who they were by spending time interviewing them, certainly, I think affected who I tended to write for, it was also a lot of O'Brien, but I like that relationship between Bashir and O'Brien. That was always fun to write for. Then something like Tarak Nor was great because I didn't have to write. I mean, other than Bashir and Dax teeing it up, being the envelope basically around it, you know, there's no characters. I think, maybe Dukat. No, it's not even Dukat who, are the rest of the story. It's all, you know, these new characters. I mean, because I had, you know, Cardassian and the Bajoran worker who's the architect who's hired to build the station. And, you know, he's obsessed with form and function, aesthetics, and wants it to be the most, you know, the beautiful thing the Cardassians ever built. And it's just so, and they have this thing in common, but he knows he's going to have to kill her. I mean, it's really, I just love Tarak Nor, but I know we're not talking about that. We're talking about Hearts and Minds, but I love Hearts and Minds. I think the one thing about Hearts and Minds, whenever I reread it, and now I really wish I'd reread it before we talked, you know, it moves like a shot. Like I remember it pacing wise. That was one of the things I was very proud of, that it moves very quick. It's very bantery. It's really fun. It feels like Star Trek. That was always the thing for me that was super important whenever I wrote these comics, how to feel like Star Trek. You know, mm-hmm. I wasn't writing, you know, for Mark Altman, I was writing for Star Trek. And so I wanted to make sure that it felt true to the universe, that nobody did anything out of character. Because some of these, you know, you look at Gold Key, excuse me. And, you know, obviously as a kid, you know, reading Gold Key, it's like where it felt nothing like Star Trek. It was fun. Yeah. I enjoyed reading them, but it doesn't feel like Star Trek. That I knew, I didn't want people to read and say, this is not the show. That I wanted it to feel like, oh my God, they could actually go and film these. Not that I ever thought they would, but I wanted to feel like, oh my God, this could be an episode. This could be the 27th and 28th and 29th and 30th episode of season one or season two or whatever.
Yep.
That was always my goal.
You totally achieved that goal, in my opinion. I was reading, when I got done reading this, it's like I felt like I had read several episodes of the TV show. And the book that I have, it's from Hero Collector, and they always have little introductions in the beginning, kind of setting up the story that you're about to read. And one of the things that when they mentioned you, they said that you didn't have much writing experience writing fiction because you had been more of a journalist. And when I got done reading this, I thought, you know, you did an excellent job of coming up with a very plausible story that I could see on the TV show of Deep Space Nine. And you did a good job of including all the characters, give them all a really good amount of screen time, for lack of a better term, in comic book terms, and also came up with a good, solid premise for a story that I could see on the TV show.
Well, thanks. I appreciate you saying that. And Rich Hanley has been very kind with his praise of, because obviously at the end of the day, I didn't write all that many. I wrote maybe 12 or give or take. And I feel like he was very generous. And, you know, had Malibu kept the license, you know, and not been folded into Marvel, I probably would have ended up writing a lot more for them. That was my goal. You know, that was always my goal. And my goal was always, like the series, to start with character. I mean, that's where it all started. Like, how does this, and this is something, you know, I learned from, again, you spending time with Michael Piller and Ira Bear and, you know, and how do they design an episode? And I tried to emulate that the same way they would do in a writer's room. I tried to do it with the comics, where it's like, start with the character rather than a high concept story and figure out how it affects our people and then come up with the story around that. So that's why, like with Requiem, you know, the whole idea of Major Kira having to confront the idea of a girl that could have been her daughter that may or may not still be alive from the war and the ghosts of the past. So it was all about how it affected sort of Major Kira, and it becomes this obsession to her. And so, you know, I built the whole, you know, sort of Diary of Anne Frank thing around her. And it was the same thing with, you know, Hearts and Minds. It was kind of like this odd couple relationship between Bashir and this Klingon. You know, I couldn't imagine a more odd relationship than the two of them. And then, you know, also how does Sisko deal with it? And so it all started. And then, you know, and then how does O'Brien get involved? And then this mystery, obviously, so all that, you know, was sort of how I would build the foundation. And I would just build up from there in terms of doing the stories. And I would definitely say that I spent probably more time on those early issues. By the time we got to Soldier of Peace, I think I had so little time to write that that I really, you know, probably wrote that super quickly.
Yeah. So, well, this story for Hearts and Minds, I thought you did an excellent job, and it to me it showed that you are somebody who is knowledgeable in Star Trek, but not being overly fan-wise when it comes to writing a story. You still want to tell a good, solid story. And for a story that, you know, you wrote 25 years ago, however long it's been, you know, you did an excellent job. And it's one that I would recommend to a lot of people that if you're a fan of Deep Space Nine, that you check out.
Yeah, well, look, I appreciate you saying that. It's like, you know, sort of I have a box of comics, you know, with the comics I wrote. And every once in a while, it's been a while since I go back and I sort of leaf through them. And I'm always like pleasantly surprised when I read them because, like you said, at the time, you know, I was writing mostly, I was an entertainment journalist then. I had, you know, I hadn't done a ton of a narrative, you know, writing. So that was really, you know, it was good to see that this stuff, you know, really worked and it was good. And then I think, you know, it was right before I did Free Enterprise. And then, you know, I did Free Enterprise shortly, maybe like a year or two after I did my last Deep Space Nine comic. So because I had done the DC comic, because that was fun too, because I guess DC had been so impressed with the stuff I was doing for Deep Space Nine. They came to me and said, can you do, would you be interested in doing, because they had the TNG license and the TOS, would you be interested in doing it? I said, well, I'd love to do TOS. I'll pay you to do TOS. And they said, we're doing a special. And so I pitched them the story, which I thought was very clever, that, you know, sort of is based, it takes place around Operation Annihilate, and it involves time travel. So it starts, you know, sort of in the movie time frame, and then it sort of goes back to the Operation Annihilate. So I actually got to do the crew in the movie universe and the crew in the original series universe, which was super fun, and it was a totally trippy. And, you know, I treated the secret of time travel, because if you look at something like Assignment Earth, where they're like, oh, we've gone back in time to observe how mankind did not destroy itself in the late, you know, 1960s. You know, time travel was sort of a rudimentary, simple thing. Yeah. Like they had mastered the art of time travel, like Doctor Who or something. Uh-huh. And so I said, you know, I made it like, basically, it's like enriching uranium. It's like the best kept secret in the Federation. We know how to time travel, but we don't really, you know, we keep it a secret. Yeah. And like nuclear weapons, you know, because obviously it's to be dangerous if it got out. So the whole idea that there's this telepathic race that, you know, learns the secret of time travel because they want to save their race from a genocide. But the person that helps them is you know, Jim Kirk's nephew who basically wants to save his parents from being killed on Dedeva. And so, again, starts with a very personal story, you know, character story that has a direct connection to Kirk, that has an emotional thing at his heart, but then, you know, there are huge galactic stakes. And that was a wonderful. The only thing about it was there were two stories. It was mine and there was one by Mike Barr. And both of them, completely by accident, nobody planned this, involved Peter Kirk, you know, involved his nephew. Yeah. And they put his story on the cover and mine was the second story. And I mine should have been the cover because it was much better. But it was, and I didn't like the art on it. In fact, I remember it was like a friend of mine for my birthday had it framed. He said, look, I'm not going to frame the cover. I'm going to frame the splash page because the cover is so awful. I said, I totally get it. And, that was, that I loved writing that, but I think it was shortly thereafter that, they either lost the license or, you know, by then I was doing movies and TV. Yeah. So, that was like the last, that was the last Star Trek comic I wrote. But, you know, it's funny, even though, you know, if they came to me and I had the time, I would totally do it again because it was super fun. I mean, no matter how busy I am doing my TV show or doing movies or whatever, it's like if somebody came and said, hey, would you want to write another Star Trek comic book? I would totally do it. I remember I talked to IDW at one point and I was surprised that they hadn't approached me, you know, especially, you know, given, you know, how beloved Free Enterprise is and everything. And then also, you know, with the success of the 50 year mission. And I didn't want to sort of lobby for it. I just kind of was talking to it. I thought, oh, well, you know, when they offer, but I guess they, you know, they never asked. So I never said anything. So, but I would love to do it again just because it's really fun. And I remember at the time, I mean, look, I was still pretty young to get a check that had the DC Comics logo on it was yep. very exciting. You know, being part of the sure. kids, you know, I was 8 years old to be getting a check from DC Comics. Because I mean, I remember probably in like junior high school, we went on a tour of DC. You know, which was in Midtown Manhattan, and it was so exciting. And I remember going to the DC Comics store and buying comics. And at the time, I think they had the vinyl for the Superman 2 soundtrack album. Uh-huh. And I was just like, "Oh, wouldn't it be amazing one day to work for DC?" So you know, when I did the comic for DC, it was just very exciting and fun and gratifying to have had that experience of doing. Doing a comic for them and it to be original and for it to be original Star Trek as well, which of course is, as good as it gets.
Oh, definitely. Well, Mark, you kind of stole my final questions by asking if you would be interested in doing, writing Star Trek comics again. So IDW, if you're listening, here's somebody that you need to hire to do a story or two.
Yeah. Well, you know, look, obviously, you know, it'd be tough because I'd want to do, either original or Deep Space Nine. I'm not really interested in doing, you know, the Kelvin universe or anything like that. So
yeah.
I don't know if there's even that, you know, but, and look, it would depend. I mean, I'm lucky enough to even, you know, be super busy between, uh-huh. you know, Pandora and some other stuff. And obviously the podcast with the,
you got plenty of irons in the fire. That's for sure.
So, you know, but I would make the time because it was really, I look back at it very, very fondly. It was shortly after I moved out to California and, right before I started making movies and television. And it was like sort of the, transitional thing, you know, doing those comics. And it was, like I said, very gratifying, very satisfying. And it always is nice. I mean, because here we are 25 years later and, you know, you contact me and like, hey, I want to talk about your comics. I mean, over two decades ago, and you're not talking about, I didn't do Spider-Man, you know, I didn't do, you know, any crazy Avengers or Batman. So, you know, the fact that people still, and I get it a lot at the conventions and things like that where people come up and still want me to sign them and are big fans. And obviously, Hero Collector putting out those wonderful volumes has been terrific because it's introduced those comics in a fabulous format to a whole new audience. And, you know, I've heard
definitely. A lot of
people saying how much they've enjoyed the comics. So that, look, that's, it's always very gratifying. It's, you know, it's always very nice whenever you do work and people appreciate it because those comics were made with love, you know, my love of Star Trek, my love of Deep Space Nine. So the fact that people like you get it and appreciate it is very gratifying.
Oh, no problem. Well, speaking of gratifying, thank you for being gracious enough to take time out of your schedule to, chat with me today and, continued success on your TV show and your podcast and everything else you got going on, sir.
Well, thank you. And you know, Jeremy, if anyone wants to, isn't already listening and they want to know more about Star Trek and hear guests from across the Star Trek universe, they can check out our podcast, The Glorious Trexperts, wherever you listen to podcasts, or the new Trexperts Briefing Room, which are audio commentaries of select Star Trek episodes with cast, crew, and filmmakers talking about significant episodes in Star Trek canon. So more Star Trek for those of them who are interested. And of course, Pandora is streaming free on Amazon Prime if they want to check out my show Pandora from the CW. And that's enough plugging for now. Oh, well, one more thing. And of course, the best-selling oral history of Star Trek, The 50-Year Mission, available in print, audio and digital. So if you haven't read my oral history with Ed Gross of the entire Star Trek saga, that's one. Speaking of a book I'm very proud of, that one is something special. So
definitely check that out. Awesome. Well, thank you very much. And it's been a pleasure to chat with you, sir.
Thank you, Jeremy. Take care.
Transfer of data is complete.
Many, many thanks to Mark A. Altman for taking time out of his very busy schedule. Come on, the guy has podcasts, he's doing a TV show, he writes books, you know, he has a lot on his plate. But he took time out of his Saturday to chat with me about this story that he wrote quite a long time ago, but it's still a good, fun story, a good, solid Deep Space Nine story. And thanks, Mark, for joining me and chatting with me and telling me about not only this story, but about your career writing Star Trek comics.
Thanks to all of you out there as well for listening to this episode of Star Trek Panel to Panel. Rest assured that there won't be a huge break from episode to episode this time around. Like I said, I've been reading through a lot of Star Trek volumes. The challenging part is trying to track down some creators that I can chat with about their stories that they did. But I'm contacting people left and right, trying to get interviews set up. So you will hear from writers, artists, creators of these wonderful Star Trek comics, hear the backstory about how they got involved in doing comics, how they got involved in doing Star Trek, and much, much more. So until the next episode of Star Trek Panel to Panel, this is Jeremy Bement saying live long and prosper, peace, and good health. Thank you for downloading this episode of Star Trek Panel to Panel, the Internet's premier podcast about Star Trek comics. You can find us on Facebook at Star Trek Panel to Panel and on Twitter at Star Trek P2P, 2 being the number 2. You can always find Star Trek Panel to Panel wherever you get your favorite podcast and can always find previous episodes on archive.org. Please let other Star Trek fans know about this podcast and leave us a positive review on iTunes. Thank you for listening, and until next time, happy reading.